Standout with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
You're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you well in this Wednesday evening. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Standout with myself, Ian O'Connell, is Brent Pope. Brent was born, raised, then spent most of his rugby playing career in New Zealand, but he has lived and worked in Ireland for most of his coaching, broadcasting, media and business career. Brent has opened up and publicly spoke about his struggles with mental health and anxiety. Sit back and enjoy the show. Brent, thanks a million for coming on today. How are you keeping?
Yeah. No, keeping okay on this particular day. So just before I start, I don't want to, you know, I've talked to you, but I don't want to feed your ego. But, you know, I came on your show specifically because I saw you on the Late Late. How many years ago was that now?
2018, April.
2018. Mm-hmm. And you came across as one of the most inspirational people I'd ever heard about your, you know, you might not be able to stand up, but you'll stand out. So, you know, you can take a huge amount of pride in what you're doing, because it's hard to give back when you're probably having a miserable time of yourself. I mean, that is so brave and courageous of you. So that is the reason that I've come on your show, because I get offered to come on shows every day, but I just, when your name came up, I thought, wow, this young man was such an inspiration to me. So thank you for that, and I'm sure from all your other listeners on your podcast or whatever would share the same views on yourself that I do. So congratulations and well done, because a life well led is a life giving back and, you know, trying to inspire other people.
Absolutely.
That's what you're doing.
Thanks a million. I appreciate them words. Like yourself, try to make the world a better place. Do you want to bring me back to your childhood growing up in New Zealand?
Yeah.
Paint a picture of what that was like.
Oh, paint a picture. It was like a Huckleberry Finn, as I, you know, maybe back before your time of book reading, Ian, but Huckleberry Finn lifestyle. I grew up in a small rural township, and it's just south of Christchurch, about an hour's drive. Very much a farming community. Had great friends. I mean, my weekends were spent, like, you know, generations ago, being kicked out of the house at 7 in the morning, out playing rugby, out swimming, out taking riding tire tubes down to the ocean, surfing in the summer, skiing in the winter. I always laugh. I say to people, I said, "What the school I went to? We had an elective, a bit like you might have geography or history, and one of that was skiing. So half a day a week, we were offered to go up skiing to Mount Hutt, which is only about 20 minutes away from my front door. And after a while, you just go, oh God, not skiing again. You know, like people laugh, like you'd say about, oh, not maths again, not maths on Wednesday afternoon for 2 hours. Part of our system was you could go skiing on the Wednesday for 2 hours. So I was born a very sickly child. I shouldn't have been born at all, in a sense, because I was born with double pneumonia and bronchitis, and the umbilical cord was trapped around my neck. So
really,
I spent the first year of my life more or less in a plastic bubble. They thought for years that I had leukemia because I was so sickly. I was a bad asthmatic. I only used to go to school, you know, 3 days a week or something. The other 2 days I'd have to be out, you know, doing asthma exercises. And I still remember the doctor, Heather Thompson, had to go to Christchurch and do all these exercises. But I grew out of it because of the lifestyle, because being in the fresh air and running and all these things, by about 12 or 13, I was probably in real good health. So, you know, it was that lifestyle that actually allowed me to overcome my early health difficulties.
Like you said, you went to Otago University. The first I'd written down here, the first ever First Division National in 91, was that?
Yeah, and when I go out and speak about, quite often I'm invited out to speak about leadership qualities. I'm sure you are yourself. I mean, you know, overcoming sort of problems in your life and stuff like that, but also the learnings that I've got from, I've been coached by some of the best coaches in the world, rugby-wise, and the learnings out of those apply in business and in life. So, yes, I went off to Otago University at a time when Otago rugby, a bit like Munster rugby, Otago was always kind of you know, mid-range to bottom range of one of the provinces, you know, like there were about, I suppose, six provincial sides in New Zealand, a bit like the four in Ireland at that stage. So we had a coach came in, Laurie Mange, who had a vision that Otago could win the national championship. I mean, the top, you know, pecking order, and probably in the world then in those days, you know, New Zealand rugby provincial level was probably the highest. I mean, Otago had beaten the Lions, England, South Africa, you know, and Auckland. Auckland had 15 All Blacks at any one time, so they're just about unbeatable. But anyway, we started playing, and it took us 3 years, but 3 or 4 years, but we ended up winning the National Division One Championship, and I was a big part of that. So, you know, I had a lot of great years. Going to university in Otago was a bit like going to university, I suppose, in Galway or something like that. The whole community was behind. So, you know, I shared a flat called the Pig Pen with 10 other guys, and, you know, people would be revolving door. Yeah, like one week somebody would be in a bedroom and saying he'd fail his courses and he'd leave, and somebody else would say, where were you last week? You know, you weren't a flatmate, but made some wonderful friends, had a great lifestyle, socialising. Rugby in those days was amateur, even though we trained as professionals. I was up at 5 or 6 in the morning every day in the gym, doing running at lunchtime, whatever. But what a lifestyle. I would say to anybody, if they get a chance to go to university or tertiary education, just do it, you know, because there's so many life lessons in meeting people and sharing your love of education and the socialising around it and all that. So rugby-wise then, I started playing for Otago, and I played for well over a decade at close to 100 games for them, which was quite hard to achieve in those days, and formed some great back row options with players who went on to captain the All Blacks or whatever like that. Unfortunately for me,
you had to withdraw your test series elbow injury, was it?
Yes, my rugby dreams were, you know, and it's still something that, you know, that I can't forget now. And I, you know, you don't like to think that you take anything to your grave, but certain some things you do. And you know, I was good enough for that at that stage. I got selected for the World Cup kind of squad in 1987, and then played trial matches against the likes of Michael Jones and that. When I just looking at my father before he died, sadly, a few years ago, I found all the scrapbooks that he had kept, which was a wonderful thing, you know, to
look back
at the house, which is a difficult job to do. I mean, how emotional was I that my dad had kept all these scrapbooks of my cuttings in a little drawer under his bed, and I never knew. And it was very emotional for me to find those. But one of the headlines was two kind of young up-and-coming superstars of rugby go head-to-head this week or something for World Cup spots, and it was Michael Jones, who went on to be, well, is still probably selected in everybody's best ever, certainly before Richie McCaw came along, but and also Zinzan Brook came in. But anyway, yes, in the final match, about a few days before the World Cup team was going to assemble, it was in New Zealand. I was rabbiting for the try line. I just won the Player of the Match award, so I could do no more. And then, bang, my rugby life changed. Guy dived in, lazily dived in. I got my arm caught behind the post. If you can imagine, it was nowhere to go, and he dived in the back of it, and my arm broken in a number of places, and I dislocated my elbow and the shoulder at the same time, all in the one go. It was a horrific accident, and when the selectors, All Black selectors, rang the hospital to say, could I take part? And the doctors then said, look, not only will he not be able to be available for the World Cup, but, you know, he might not play rugby again. Now, I battled back the year later. It took me a year of recovery, but I battled back to get one of the players of the year the year later. But the opportunity of being a small town kid from Ashburton in New Zealand, who had never really had any players at that level, to suddenly winning a World Cup medal that I would still have now in 1987, for all that to be taken away in an instant, I understand players that are in GAA or that have had that same sort of disappointment, and how much it actually, you know, at the time I played it off like I did everything, but it was just another, issue that I put under the carpet that would come back to haunt me a few years later. But a huge disappointment. I still look back to this day and say, you know, how good could I have been? Could I have been a Zin Zambrook? Could I have been a Michael Jones? Could I have been one of these great players? And yeah, sometimes in the dark of night, I think, yeah, I could have been if I'd have been given that chance. But my life had to move in different directions. And in a sense, that sort of prompted me, I suppose, to come to Ireland because of all those disappointments. I was struggling with my mental health then. And so I needed to get a fresh environment to restart my, reboot my career, whatever that looked like.
Now, if you want to get in contact with me throughout the show on any questions or requests, you can contact me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or drop me an email on my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie. We're going to go for a very quick ad break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back after these.
Stand Out with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome back to Stand Out with me, Ian O'Connell, here on Radio Kerry. I'm here today with former New Zealand rugby player and television pundit Brent Pope.
And you said you got named Player of the Year. I think that was in 97, 98.
Yeah, it was the same. It was the year after I came back. I battled back from that injury after the All Blacks had won the World Cup and everything. And I really made an effort to say, OK, I can do a bit like yourself, although, you know, far less serious. I decided then and there what I had to do, what I had to do to get back. And I just trained so hard and I rehabbed so hard over that period because I didn't want it to end then. I wanted to come back and prove to myself and prove to other people that I could come back. Now I was bandaged and my arm wouldn't straighten out, still doesn't now, but I did manage to battle back to being at the top level again, and which was a huge achievement coming from where I came from the injury originally.
And you said that you were unlucky, obviously, with injury and stuff.
Yeah.
You were, I think it was, did you miss out again on the tour to Japan? Was it they cut it from 5 to 24?
Talk about God's will. So, that following year when I came back and got one of the players, I was Otago Player of the Year, and I was also one of the three domestic across New Zealand players of the year that year. The other ones being, I think, John Gallagher, who was in the All Blacks, and I think John Kirwan. But anyway, so then I got a letter. My mother actually leaked. They were announcing the All Blacks to tour Japan, and they were due to take 26 players on that tour because they only had 4 games. Usually they would have taken 30 players, but they cut it down because they're only 3 or 4 games. But anyway, My mother's friend through racing or whatever, through horse racing, he was sat on the board of sort of the New Zealand Rugby Union board, a bit like the Irish Rugby Union. Anyway, They announced the team, and he secretly went out to a phone and rang my mother, and she rang me, and she said, Brent, she said, don't announce it to anybody, but you've made the All Blacks again or whatever, or you're in the All Blacks or something. So at the same time, I received a letter, a sponsorship letter, saying, you know, you've got to go down and get these photos taken, and you've got to sign a deal with Steinlager to promote their stuff. And so I kept all this quiet, you know. And even in the headlines, look in the scrapbooks, my father has Otago player Brent Pope certain to be named in the All Blacks tomorrow. And then overnight, I heard that they were cutting the touring party by 2 players. And so when the team was announced the next day, I wasn't in it. And I think I rang another player, I think Herb Schuler or something, who also missed out at the same time. But yeah.
Talk about bad luck, though. You know?
Bad luck, yeah. You know, like, you know, I still have that letter, actually. I still have that letter now to say congratulations or something, you know. They sign all these things for the Steinlager, who were the beer brand at that stage, who were sponsoring the All Blacks, and you know, you need to sign this disclaimer that, you know, that you'll wear their gear and stuff in Japan and stuff like that. And you know, to get that call from my mother, she's all excited, you know, wanting to tell her friends and Ashburton, and I just said, look, hold off, anything could happen. But I just kind of thought it was, in a way, kind of, I'm not I'd like to be more spiritual in my life. I was brought up a pretty strict Catholic, but in a way, I kind of thought, Ian, this is kind of God's message to me somewhere. That's the way I kind of viewed it. I thought it's just not meant to be, you know. Yeah. I was lucky enough to wear the black jersey at different levels and do the hark and all those things and play in front of 60,000 or 70,000 people. I've achieved all that. It would have been nice to fulfill something that I never thought that I would.
Yeah.
You know, I was quite I know I can talk for Ireland now, but I was quite a shy kid. I didn't have a lot of confidence. Even when I used to tell my parents that I was playing somewhere else because I didn't want them to come along and watch me play. Really? I suffered a lot of comfort. When I should have put my name forward, Ian, I was always the person that would take the disappointments. I was always someone that the coach would come to and say, Brent, you know, don't argue back. When I should have put my name forward, other players were, and I was always the one that's sort of sat in the background and said, well, give my position to someone else or do something else, because I was always about team first. I certainly wasn't an egotistical player. I was always about, you know, promoting the team before I promoted myself. But looking back now, I just wish I'd had more confidence in my ability at a younger age, because it took me a long time to get to that level to say, hey, I'm good enough. I'm actually good enough and I'm worthy enough of selection, and that took me a while.
And like
that had something to do with all my issues at that time around panic attacks and anxiety issues and that, because, you know, a lot of that, for a lot of people know what I'm talking about, a lot of that comes from a lack of confidence and a lack of self-belief that you're good-looking enough, that you're talented enough, that you're good at sport, that you're good at anything, because that's an inward journey rather than outward. I was physically fit, you know. I was probably as fit as any player in the country. I just wasn't mentally fit.
Yeah. And I can relate there what you said about kind of spiritually, that it wasn't meant to be, because when I had my accident, I was supposed to be flying to Spain by myself the next morning over to my students. So I always say something like, something worse could have happened over there. That's the way I look at it. Before we move on from rugby, because I want to touch a good bit on the more mental health side of things, when you came to Ireland, do you want to tell me what was that like the first time you came, coming from New Zealand all the way over, and you were played and coached with St. Mary's, did you?
Yeah. Well, a quick funny story that you talk about how rugby has changed, you know. I arrived over and, I was contacted by... At the end of that season, when I'd missed out in Japan, I went and played a season in the UK and was probably one of the first players from New Zealand to play in the then kind of league with the we made up three or four teams from around Blackheath and that, and played it against Gloucester and Leicester and all those things. Provincial championship then. So then I came back to New Zealand. I had another great season, actually. I think it was the season we won the championship. And at the end of that season, I thought, okay, other seasons I've gone off and played in other countries. Like I played a season in the States, which was great, in San Diego there. We won a national championship there with Ombak or whatever. That was probably the first that anybody had done that as well, to win two championships in the same year in different countries. Then I went back to New Zealand. I got contacted by... I think Benetton or whatever, one of those clubs in Italy, and then I also got contacted about 2 days later from St. Mary's Rugby Club in Dublin. Would I come over and have a 3-month sabbatical and play a bit of rugby, end of season? So I said, okay. I wanted to go somewhere that was English speaking. I didn't want to go somewhere that I'd find the communication difficult for that period of time, and it would have made a good change for me. So I decided to do that. So anyway, I came over, and I was met by three or four players from the St. Mary's team at the airport, and that was fine. And during the day, it was a Friday, during the day, and I didn't know where I was staying, and during the day, they palmed me off onto other players where they went back to work, and it all involved a couple of pints with every player. So at the end of the day, you know, I rolled out of Leeds nightclub in Leeson Street there, which all the rugby fans did.
How rugby has changed, Brent.
It was pretty worse for wear after the long flight and also a few pints, and it was raining, and I didn't know. All the players had left me. They had palmed me onto other players, and they had just gone. So I came out, and a taxi driver took pity on me and said, "Where are you staying, son?" I thought, I don't know. I didn't have a phone in those days, no mobiles. I didn't have enough money, typical of a New Zealander. Didn't have enough money to get me through. So he said, "Look," I said, "All I know is I'm playing for a rugby club called St Mary's." So he said, "Look, I'll take you up to the club. There may be someone still up." It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And he put me up the club in Temple over there with the pitch dark, and of course there was no one up then. He said, "Well, look, I can do no more for you." I don't know why he didn't invite me back to stay in his house or something, as most Irish people would do. But so he left me at the club, so I ended up staying the first night at the rugby club in the foyer with my jacket over the top of me, soaking wet, shivering, and then the next morning someone came down to open up the club rooms for the mini rugby, and he stood over me, and I was still trying to sleep or whatever, and he said, "Oh, you must be a foreign player, Brent Pope or something." I said, "That's me," or something. He said, "I'll take." I thought, talk about a welcome. Can you imagine Brian O'Driscoll or something going over to play in Toulon in France or something and being put out into the foyer? But rugby has changed. So
now we're going to go for a very quick ad break. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to Radio Kerry. We'll be back after these.
Stand Out with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry. Stand Out with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome back to Stand Out here on Radio Kerry with me, Ian O'Connell.
Yeah, so I came over and I played for Mary's for a number of seasons. We got through to the final of the AL, where unfortunately I let everybody down, including myself, and I got involved in an altercation and was sent off in that match, and we lost that final. That was probably the greatest final that was ever played in club rugby. And those were days when all the top players played club matches.
Yeah.
You know, Peter Costas and Ron O'Gara and all these players would play club rugby, Axel Foley, all these players. So then I decided that, you know, I'd like to stay in Ireland for a few years. So I went back and played another a season with Otago, in that season they beat the Lions and they beat the South Africans. Then I came back and decided that Ireland was where I wanted to be. I then wanted to cut my teeth in coaching because I thought I'd gone as far as I could in the playing. I was then 32 or 33.
Did you always know you wanted to dip into coaching after playing?
No, not really.
Really?
Because again, I had a lot of knowledge in the game because I played three different positions in the back row, 6, 7, and 8. So I had a good knowledge. Captains from loose forwards make good captains because, you know, you've got to know a bit about back play and got to know a bit about forward play. So I got offered a kind of a role over in Clontarf, who were then at that stage right down the ranks. Now they're the top club side in the country. But in those days, we were languishing on the bottom of Division 3. Mary's was Division 1. So I went over there and I just loved it. And I loved learning more about players and getting into the gradually involved in the coaching. They then let their coach go mid-season and they kind of came to me with an ultimatum as either you take over the coaching or you can go as well, because
really?
In those days I hadn't played. You weren't allowed to play for a new club if you transferred before Christmas. So I took off the coaching. I took over the coaching, and straight away I took all the learnings from my other coaches that I'd had at New Zealand level or provincial level and applied all those same principles. And I remember how things changed for them as well. Suddenly they went away from being probably known as a drinking team within a week to saying, "Look, to the players, you can't drink anymore leading up to games." Before, I remember a few of the players walked out the gate. They soon came back. So I built a team out there. We won Division 3, we won Division 2 the next year, we won the Leinster Senior Cup, we qualified as the top Leinster team, we beat St Mary's 25-3 or something. That was a fantastic victory for me in St Mary's, and we won two or three Floodlit Cups. And then I got invited to come back to St Mary's because they had never won the First Division, and I came back in their centennial year and we won the First Division. So I won three divisions of the All-Ireland League. I won a couple of Leinster Cups and a couple of Floodlit Cups and that. So I was very successful. I then had to make a decision on my IPN, and I was really enjoying the media at that stage. I'd gone into RTE to work on the panels. So there came a situation that I had to make two decisions. One of them was, do I apply for a job in UCC as director of sport, which I went down, and I would have loved that job looking back, but I couldn't continue the media work because work was on weekends and I had to be with the team. So I decided then and then to finish up the coaching and go into the media side of it. Now, looking back, you know, was that the right decision or wrong decision? I don't know, because I would have liked again to have coached professionally. I also coached the Leinster A side for a while with Mike Ruddock and players Brian O'Driscoll, Gordon Darcy, Leo Cullen, all those players were in the team. And I had a couple of offers from France, whatever, go coaching. But my love was in the media then.
Yeah. It's amazing. That story, that's when you came over and signed the couples with the taxi man. I want to touch on the more serious side now of the interview when it comes to mental health, something that's not spoken about enough and something that I'm, as yourself, so passionate about, because I've try my best to use my platform to help people with their mental health and stuff. Do you want to bring me back to, I suppose, when
the start
first came into your life?
Yeah, I remember vividly, as I'm sure you remember parts of your life, you know, you want to try to forget. And I remember the first panic attack I had was actually sitting in a bath on a Sunday night for some reason. I don't know whether I was 13 or 14. I don't know that much detail, but I know the feeling. And people often ask me, you know, that have had them, they know what I'm talking about. People that haven't had panic attacks don't know. For me, it wasn't triggered by anything. I didn't have any stresses in my life at that stage. Now, I could have been genetically predisposed. You know, my father was always a very anxious man. He'd admit that himself. My brother has had his own issues around bipolar and these things. So genetically, I possibly was more vulnerable or susceptible.
Is there a difference between mental health and anxiety?
Not at that level.
Really?
People often ask me that question. There's two things I say to most people is that, yes, there is a difference between there's various mental health issues, as you know, like, that I don't talk about because I don't know enough about them. But, you know, anorexia, for instance, or body dysmorphia is a form of mental illness. Bipolar, where people have their highs or their lows. Then you've got the depression axis. Then you've got the, you know, Asperger's, autism. There's a whole kind of Venn diagram, if you know, of various mental disorders. So I don't want to categorize people into any of them. But For my life, it started off with kind of, I suppose, extreme anxiety in the form of panic attacks, and then it moved through different gears over my life. Sometimes it could be generalized anxiety, just feeling anxious for no reason, not at panic attack level, not having to sit there shaking and have the physical manifestations, but knowing that it's I just woke up the other day, for instance, and I just thought, Brent, you're really anxious today.
Yeah.
Not about anything. I didn't have to do. I didn't have to speak anywhere. I didn't have to do anything like that. People might say, oh, well, I know why you're anxious. Just this feeling of anxious.
Just comes and goes as it please.
Yeah.
You could wake up and
exactly. You know, you probably, we've all experienced that at some times. You know, mostly for most people, it's been driven by, you know, have they a date or have they have a driver license? Have they an exam? Have they had an argument with their parents or their girl? You know, but for generalized anxiety, no, there doesn't have to be a trigger, and that's what people find it hard to understand.
I always wondered that, so it's good, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners will be the same. I remember you were on Tommy Tiernan there not too long ago talking to him, and he's someone I actually look up to for interviewing skills, because he's very good, like he lets the guests talk, and I thought it was a great interview. You said that 2021 was tough here. Yeah. It was tough for everybody, and I'm sure, like a lot of people, their mental health kind of worsened during it because we weren't getting out, and and meeting people. How did you find the lockdown and COVID yourself? Because obviously it was like a whole different world.
Yes, you know, just quickly putting back, I've managed my mental health over the years particularly well.
Yeah,
I've had a couple of blips along the way, but I've been able to recognise them and get things sorted.
Deal with them fast.
You know, and part of that, the same for you. Part of that is the advocacy work that I do to say to people, look, I've been there. Yeah. Wherever you've been, I've been there myself. And just to say to people out there, look, if you just are brave enough to reach out for help, then get your life sorted, that you don't have to go through this alone. So that's the message for me, because I don't have my own family. I don't have my family here, and that can be quite isolating. I lost my dad before COVID. So yes, it was a difficult period. All yeah. that into the pot, a bit like yourself, all that into the pot, because you know, when you have something that's chronic, or when you have something, when you're in pain every day, and I've asked you about your nerve pain before, I know what it's like. When you're in pain every day, sooner or later, it spills over.
It's inevitable, isn't it? It has to come. Yeah. It has to come
because you find it very hard to deal with. You find it very hard to deal with that kind of situation where a lot of people deal with, that it doesn't affect your mental health at some stage. Sometimes you just get a bit. You get a bit down about, oh, well, you know, like I'm feeling I can't do what I used to do. I can't enjoy certain things that I used to enjoy. You know, I couldn't socialize. I don't socialize as much as I like to. I haven't had a drink in 3 years. I'm not saying that was a big part of my life, but it was a nice to be able to go out and have a wine with a meal or something like that. You know, I was never a big drinker, but all those things were taken away. I don't even sleep, you know, which is crucially important. I wake up 10 times a night.
Now we're going to go for our last ad break. Stay tuned into Radio Kerry. Lots more to come in the last part of the show. We'll be straight back after these.
Stand Out with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Now you're very welcome back to Stand Out with me, Ian O'Connell, here on Radio Kerry.
So then I just found myself in a bit of a funk, you know, yeah. Like, you know, I'd known what that felt like before. You know, I'd had maybe weekends where I was probably feeling a bit low or whatever like that, but I managed to, you know, haul myself out of it. I just got into a situation whereby it became relentless, you know, this, and that had a lot to do with COVID too, because I couldn't go back and see my family in New Zealand. I couldn't meet up with friends. I didn't have work. A lot of work I lost. I finished up an RTE, which in 2019, the World Cup before, there was no rugby. There was no, you know, you couldn't even go to the movies. You know, there was just yeah. like, and that all sort of came tumbling down, as it did for a lot of people. And I just found myself in a situation, you know, I know the media like to overplay things, and sometimes that's not good for people's mental health either. But you know, I just knew, you know, the lesson in this, a bit like yourself, is what you try to do is, no matter where you are, no matter how you feel, you've just got to reach out for help. And if you think like me, that needed to come from a professional arm. I mean, suddenly I found that the journaling and the counselling sessions that I was still doing just weren't enough anymore.
Yeah,
you know, they weren't enough to stop me progressing along that lines where I didn't want to progress. I wanted somebody to come in with a magic wand and say, Brent, you'll wake up tomorrow and everything will be fine. Your physical health will be fine, your mental health will be fine, and we'll be out of COVID and everything will be back to normal. I just wanted my life to be normal again. And that's the hardest thing, you know, I should imagine that you deal with, is at times you go back and you say, I just want to feel normal again, but yeah. life has changed and it's moved on, and we have to come to some form of acceptance. So I just realized then that I needed to talk to someone at a higher professional level and get their opinion on what I could do to help, whether or not I needed to go on medications, or whether or not I needed to see a different type of counselor, or whether in fact I needed to go into to be scrutinized a bit more. So, but I do believe that call did really change the direction of my well-being on a positive. At least I knew I was getting help. You know,
do you think
the people I appeal to, the people that don't?
Yeah, do you think that's the hardest thing? Because a lot of people I've talked to know with mental health, they say reaching out is the hardest part of it. Once you reached out, did you find the weight off your shoulders?
Yeah, that's a really, really, really positive message to say, and I'm glad you said that, because that people have to realise that, that is the hardest step you will make. Yeah. It's a bit like, I suppose, an alcoholic who's down on his luck and in the bottom of a gutter. If he makes that first step to go to the AA or something, that first little journey is a step to change your life, and that applies the same as men. See, we need to look at mental health in that thing as being an illness, no different from somebody having to go down to the doctor for a virus or for COVID or for a broken leg or whatever, because we can see that. The scary thing about mental health is we can't see it.
Yeah.
And we can't imagine. I can't imagine how some people look after their mental health, because I'm not them.
Yeah.
So people want to speak to you. The worst thing about mental health or mental illness is, forget about destigmatizing. I'm sick of telling people the same as what you're probably told. Oh, you're destigmatizing mental health. No, it's more about, let's have a greater understanding of what it is. Don't try to judge. I talk to parents all the time, and they say, what we can do? And I said, just be the best listener in the world. Don't try to direct somebody that's suffering from mental health issues to your way of life. Don't say, oh, you know, go for a cold swim or man up, or, you know, because that's not the way people think, and you're not them.
Yeah.
You know, so it's about saying, hey, you know, I hear you. You know, it was a wonderful thing said by a person I met in years ago. And she said her mother just didn't understand her, and she ended up in a psychiatric ward and was being treated and stuff like that. And she said the most loving thing her mother said was, you know, I don't get it, but I get you. And I thought that was lovely. You know, I'll never understand, but I understand you, and we'll get through this together. So yes, in a long-winded way, making that first step is the hardest, but it is the most crucial.
Absolutely. You're involved in a lot of different charities to do with mental health and stuff, and there's some great ones out there, like the Cycle Against Suicide, and there's so many good ones. How important do you think it is for people to get involved and to support these charities so they can be there for people suffering?
Well, I throw that question back to you. You know, how important is it to you? I mean, how important has it been in your life since that tragic day in that accident? How important has it been to you, mental health-wise, to work in advocacy? I'd say extremely important. That's what you do. It's what you need to be known for, because you're giving back, and that's why you can look with such pride on what you do, because that is nothing. I was out going for a walk the other day. I have to walk every day. That's another thing that I love to do. I just get down by the sea and it clears my head. If I'm feeling a bit anxious, a bit generalized anxious, get out, you know, go for a walk, clear the head, fresh air, all those things that I learned from sport. Just to be with nature and to be, all these things I practice, and I'm sure you do, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to be grateful sometimes, and I'm sure in your situation that's doubly hard, but I mean, to be grateful that you're here and that you have your family around you and you have support and you're well loved and respected, and you know that the next day is a new beginning. These are all things that keep you going in the darkest of times. And you know, it's very brave, but we have to do it. We have to try to find something in the day that propels us forward. And unfortunately, I suppose the area that I'm in is that, you know, what's the alternative for young people? And the alternative is that they feel alone, they feel isolated, they feel that there's nothing worth living for again, and, you know, and they think about, you know, doing something drastic. And, you know, even so, when I was out there for a walk, a guy pulled up in his car and he just came over and he shook my hand and he said, when I was feeling, as I do, for going on the interviews and that, feeling judged, you know, when I come off those interviews, it's quite traumatic for me, because I think, have I shared too much? Have I shared my dirty little secret? Does everybody know now? And what does everybody think of me? And my first go-to place is, everybody will think, oh, your man, I'm glad I'm not your man, Brent Pope or something, I'm glad I'm not like him or whatever like that, and is really hard for me to deal with. But when I have people coming across the road and shaking your hand and saying, Brent, I listen to you, you know, and, you know, I'm just to say that, you know, you saved my life too, you know, at some stage. I heard you talk and I reached out for, and it just overwhelms me with emotion, because I just feel like, okay, I am making a difference. And a bit like you, if we touch one person in the room, one person that can deal with an injury like yours in a more positive way, despite them feeling that all is lost, if I can touch one person that is maybe in a dark place that makes that phone call and starts their life over again, then that's what life is about for me, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's what it should be about, and that's why I urge people to get involved in helping out. I mean, the world's become a very lonely place for a lot of people, and loneliness in this country is a killer. People are isolated, you know, farmers or whatever down, you know, people from small communities may have lost their business, may have lost everything like that. It's very isolating, and we need to pay more care to people and love people and be more empathetic. So I've lost too many friends, many friends, not just colleagues that I work with in the industry, because as a counselor, you know, you meet a lot of people think, I've lost too many personal friends that have taken their own life. I don't want to see another person in this country, anywhere around the world, that gets to that stage without knowing that there's help out there to change their lives. And just that's why I came up with this project, The Elephant in the Room. Hopefully I can come back to you on a podcast, because I know you have a lot of listeners, to really get behind this project, which will be recognition from companies. I want an elephant in every schoolroom, to every boardroom in the country, as a recognition that they are committed to creating a workplace, a school environment, a sports club or whatever, whereby it's okay to talk about what the elephant in the room is for you. Could that be sexuality issues? Could there be issues around injuries? Could there be issues around racism? Whatever it is, that people can express that and say, hey, okay, I'm vulnerable here. I'm putting myself out there, out of my comfort zone, as you do every day, to be accepted, and to be giving something back. So that's an exciting project for me. I'm much older than you, so that's what's become important in my life, giving back to community, giving back to Ireland, giving back to the mental health, and that's the best area I know how. Like you do, that's the area that I know, and that's giving back. So look, sorry for gabbing on.
Definitely, that it's a great initiative, and when it's going out, I'd love to be able to pump it out there as well.
Look, thanks very much for the opportunity. I'm delighted to meet you, and say, you know, there's huge admiration for the work that you do, and you've overcome your tragic circumstances in the best possible way. So I can't talk more about you as a young man, about what you've done for the country and for community and for your family and for yourself. So,
and I'm sure we'll cross paths somewhere.
We'll cross paths again. Keep up the good work, brother. You're doing
a million. Thanks so much, Brent. Take care.
Now, unfortunately, that's all we have time for tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I appreciate you tuning in as always. A massive thanks to Brent for coming on today and sharing his story, because it's not an easy one to talk about, and he's giving out a great message to people out there that are suffering with their own mental health and anxiety issues. And hopefully that hearing Brent's story gave you a bit of comfort and a bit of hope to hopefully share your own, and to put a smile on your face and help you. If you want to get in contact with me before next week's show, you can contact me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or through my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie. Stay tuned into Radio Kerry, because Brian Priestley is up next with That's Jazz. I'll be back at the same time next week from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.